Good evening, everyone. So tonight we've come to the final class in our series, and it's been an interesting exercise to go through the whole book of Esther. I think it's a story that we all love, and get to know the characters a little bit better, a little bit deeper, and some of the spiritual meaning, the important spiritual lessons behind the characters and the events that take place. So we've been through the characters of Esther and Mordecai, of Haman, and then we saw that the flesh must be put to death, and that's going to come out once again as Haman is finally destroyed tonight. In Esther chapter 4, we looked at Esther's conversion in her way of thinking, from thinking to preserve herself to transforming, to be someone who was to stand up, to risk her life for the benefit of others, showing true agape love. And last week we looked how God was at work behind all the events that were going on. Three banquets kept on delaying, you know, the activities with Haman, as he was building a gallows for Mordecai, but still God was working. And we saw the great reversal when Mordecai and Haman's positions were effectively reversed. So tonight we're going to conclude by looking at Esther chapter 7, and we'll see how God is the ultimate strategist in terms of our salvation. Okay, so he's doing this for our salvation so that we can all get into the kingdom. And he knows in advance what's best for us, and often, and rightly so, that will mean that we have to go through trials and tribulations to get into the kingdom of God. And finally, in Esther chapter 8 and 9, we're going to look at the Persian Express Post, which delivered in its day a wonderful message of light, joy, gladness, and honour. So Esther chapter 7, the game of life. And you can see I've got the picture of a chessboard here on the screen, and I presume everyone is fairly familiar, reasonably familiar with the game of chess, having played one or two games in their life. Now, you see, what the key, you know, if you, those familiar with chess, you know a fundamental rule is never underestimate your opponent's queen. It's the most powerful player on the board, isn't it? Can move in more directions than any other piece on the chessboard. So never underestimate your opponent's queen. But see, this is exactly what Haman had done. He'd failed to keep his eyes on the queen. He overlooked Esther's role. He underestimated Esther. He effectively thought she was just a pawn. And he failed to consider her importance in the match. And this would be his undoing. You know, he'd already mapped out his next few moves with deadly precision, hadn't he? He'd just finished building a 75-foot gallows, you know, three stories high, upon which to hang Mordecai. And he had Mordecai in check, and was now only hours away from declaring a cruel but decisive checkmate. But then something unexpected happened. All of a sudden, in a series of events, the tables were turned because he hadn't kept his eyes on the queen. He hadn't done his homework. He'd been knocking piece after piece off his opponent's board without noticing the most important player, the queen. And so we saw last week that chapter 6 ended with Haman leaving for the queen's second dinner party after being warned by his family, who originally told him to build the gallows for Haman. Now they could see the writing on the wall. They said, look, be careful. Your career's in jeopardy. But unknown to him, unknown to Haman, there was more than just a career to lose. Okay, so let's read the first two verses of chapter 7, please.
So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half my kingdom? It shall be done.
The king hadn't forgotten the main reasons for these banquets. Okay, this is the third time now that Esther's called them together. And he's saying again, what is it? What are you after, Esther? What is it? He was dying to know what Esther wanted. And he uses the expression, I'll give you even up to half of my kingdom. Third time, he's promised that. Now, I don't think that's just something he says lightly to anyone. He doesn't say that to just anyone. He's saying that because he really means it. And it means that it just shows the genuine love, respect, and appreciation that he had for Esther. And he knew that she was an indispensable part of his life. He valued her so much. And it was obvious to him that what she was about to ask was very important. He could probably read the stress and the concern all over her face. And he was so worried. And he really wanted to help her. So I think this expression, you know, it just tells us a little about the character of the king again, that he's not such a bad egg that a lot of people make him out to be. And he certainly, you know, knows and appreciates Esther for her character. And it's a complete contrast, isn't it, with Herod's promise. The expression, you know, I'll give you up to half your kingdom, you might know, is repeated in when Herod gave the promise to give up to half his kingdom to Herodias' daughter for dancing to him in Mark chapter 6, which was stated in a drunken state, you know, that he later regretted, absolutely regretted ever making such a statement. But this is something very, very different, entirely different. There was true intent, there was true concern, and he would have followed through on whatever Esther required, because he knew that what she was going to ask wasn't something silly, wasn't something selfish. He knew it was something really important that would affect him as well. And we suggested the actual connection last week too, that perhaps by this stage Esther had one or two children or was pregnant, one or all of the above. But that would also explain why he was prepared to give Esther so much, knowing that it would go to his sons as well. And so the queen finally reveals herself in verse 3 and 4. So let's keep reading, please.
Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favour in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss."
All right, thank you. Now, here she is quoting almost directly from Haman's edict in Esther chapter 3, verse 13. "We are going to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated," is what Haman said was the decree issued, to kill, to annihilate all Jews, young, old, women and children in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month. And she's no longer silent, is she? She stands up. The intimidation factor is gone. Now all she wanted was life. She wasn't concerned anymore about her position, you know, that the Queen of Persia bestowed upon her, with all the attendants, with all the properties, with all the, you know, everything else that went along with her. That meant nothing to her now. All that she was concerned about was the life of herself and for her people. And so also she finally here confesses to being a Jew. For more than 5 years, she kept this a secret from the king. Remember that, and that was on Mordecai's advice back in Esther chapter 2, verse 10, when Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. Her motto had been, "I'm a Jew on the inside, but a Persian on the outside." But now, in this courageous petition, Esther openly declares to the king and his Jewish-hating friend, Haman, who she was, who she belonged to, both in life and death. "I am a Jew, Ahasuerus," is what she's saying. "And if they perish, then I perish with them." Now, at this point, the king may not have caught on to what Esther was doing, but Haman certainly had. He was now but a pawn being chased by the queen. You know, in the final stage of the game of chess, you know, it's no longer so much a game of strategy and thinking and planning your moves. It becomes a game of chess, you know, with the queen chasing one pawn around until she gets in. So that's exactly what's happening now. Haman's being chased. He can see it. And so in doing this, note that Esther protects the king while drawing closer to moving on Haman. it's actually a fascinating, this in verse 4 here is a fascinating admission by Esther. She told the king that if the Jewish people were merely being sold into slavery, she wouldn't have said anything to him. But they weren't being sold into slavery. they were going to be killed. Mass genocide, weren't they? And the king was hearing that his wife was in danger. And he probably didn't even know why. Now, remember, we talked about this last week. Ahasuerus most likely allowed Haman to write the first edict in chapter 3 without ever being informed about the particulars of the coming massacre. Haman just said it to certain people. And all the king knew that some traitors that were causing trouble were going to be put to death, and he was blinded at the time by the promise of so much more money flowing into his coffers. So the king's slowly waking up to what's going on. But in so doing, Esther avoided giving any details that would implicate the king, even though it was his signature, wasn't it, that was on the death warrant that Haman had sent all over the Persian Empire. Now, later, Esther would have told the king the whole story, including the fact that she and Mordecai were cousins. But right now, she simply wanted to know that she wanted her husband, the king, to know that someone out there planned to kill her and her extended Jewish family. That's all she's revealed to the king to this point. She hasn't revealed it to Haman quite yet. She's just revealed that right now, her and her Jewish family, their life is in jeopardy. Now, Haman, however, had just discovered to his great shock that Esther was a Jewess. You know, and Esther's strong language here, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated, you know, was taken directly, as I said before, from the portion of the edict that he had written that left no loophole for the life of any Jew. And Haman had been anxiously awaiting the day when he could lawfully take off their heads and ending the Jewish bloodline and vindicating his forefather, King Agag, the king of the Amalekites. But unlike the king, Haman understood what Esther was talking about very clearly, okay? And he now knew that this didn't bode well for him at all. And so Esther then moves into checkmate. Keep reading, please, David, verses 5 and 7 of chapter 7, 5 to 7.
Then King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "This adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king.
All right, so Esther no longer restrained now. She hurled a dagger with this statement, didn't she? She built the tension up, okay, didn't she, in verse 6. The king said, "Who is he? Where is he? Where is he? Wait till I get my hands on him." And Esther said, "He's a foe. No, not just Haman, but a foe, an enemy." And then she lets the cat out of the bag, "This wicked Haman." And so all the walls that Haman had carefully constructed around him came crashing down. And the king was so shocked and infuriated that all he could do, all he decided to do, was to rush out into the garden to digest what had happened. And what must he have been thinking at this time? It's probably a good thing he did go out like that instead of staying. He had quite a situation on his hand, didn't he? He was actually feeling the corners of the chessboard himself. He was being chased around in this game. How could he punish Haman for an edict stamped with his own royal seal? How could he deal with Haman without admitting his own role in signing this decree? How could he rescind this decree, which was now the law of the Medes and the Persians? How could he possibly soften this down that demanded the total destruction of all the Jews when there was no loophole? And perhaps more importantly, how could he protect his loving wife's life, Esther's life, while at the same time protect his own reputation? And if he couldn't, if he failed, how was he going to explain Esther's death? And so the king was frustrated, not just at Haman, but can you see how frustrated and annoyed he would have been with himself? Why did I trust Haman so completely? Why in the world did I sign that edict? Why didn't I read the fine print of what Haman was up to? And so, but while, you know, the king was out in the garden thinking about these things, Esther showed no remorse at all for Haman. This quiet, gentle spirit did not just meekly sit back and let Haman rule her life. Haman tried to beg for his life from Esther, but no tears are shed from Esther's point of view. Her tears will flow in the next chapter, verse 3, when she appeals to the king to save her people. And if you read closely further on in verse 8, Haman, based on the king's reaction when he came in and saw Haman assaulting Esther, which was correct, it's evident that Haman one last time tried to assault and force her, trying to convince her to change her mind. So at first he was on the floor begging, then step two, when that didn't work, he tried, look, who do you think you are? You know, you're just a Jew. I'm the prime minister. What are you doing? He really got aggressive with her. But Esther refused his pleas, knowing that you don't spare Haman just as you don't spare Agag. Okay? They are only fit to be put to death. And so God is teaching us that King Sin, Diabolos, will be cast down, can be defeated before all who are prepared to stand up to it. But you've got to be ruthless about it. You've got to be prepared and resolute to put it to death. Now, according to Persian law, two serious accusations, two serious, well-documented, well-supported pieces of evidence were required before someone could be condemned to death. So this is what the king needed. So in verse 8, let's read this again, Paul. We haven't read it yet. So David, please read verse 8.
When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face.
So, you know, in frustration and terror, it looks like Haman actually fell on Esther's couch where she was. He likely knelt over her and then proceeded, as I mentioned before, to grab her by the shoulders to try and force the situation, to try and get her to change her mind. And this is when, at that moment, when the king came back in and saw what Haman was doing to Esther and was absolutely shocked. Now, Persian law stated, as I said, that no man was allowed within 7 paces of any member of the king's harem. And also touching the king's, and also if you touched the king's wife, even just touching her, that was punishable by death. And as I said before, the king's observation of what occurred is correct. Haman was assaulting her. He was grabbing her and shaking her, trying to get her to change her mind. And so they covered Haman's face. According to a Persian custom, because according to a Persian's custom, a condemned man was no longer worthy to be looked upon or to look upon another. And so the king was able to condemn Haman to death so quickly because, as it said, Persian law requires 2 serious accusations. He had it first. Haman's plot to kill the Jews was the first one. That was now revealed. And that would have been a direct threat to his own wife. And now, secondly, he came back in. Haman was assaulting Esther. Okay, that was the second bit of evidence that would complete the story. However, to completely tip the legal scales over and to make sure that Ahasuerus simply had no doubt whatsoever that he could legally put Esther to death, one more thing happened, and it was the voice of a servant. A servant spoke up that confirmed that Haman deserves to die. Verse 9, please, David.
Now Habona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it.
All right, thanks. So, you know, Harbona, now he's mentioned in chapter 1, verse 10, one of the 7 eunuchs that served the king. You remember the story with Vashti, that she wouldn't come to the feast? So the king sent these 7 eunuchs, one by one, Okay? Not all at the same time, but one by one to try and appeal to Vashti to come to the feast. So Harbona was one of those servants. And this servant emphasized what Mordecai had done in saving the king, and that Mordecai was planning to kill him. You know, he suddenly spoke up. Well, he's in the background, just sort of off in the corner of the room there, and he comes forward and says, "Excuse me, Your Highness, but you should take a look outside your window and see the gallows or the big pole that Haman has built for Mordecai. You remember Mordecai, don't you? He's the hero who you just made a benefactor because he saved your life. Haman's trying to kill this man that has been so loyal to you." So there it was. Now there was three legitimate reasons that the king had to condemn Haman. And everything could be viewed through the lens of political intrigue or corruption on Haman's part and his disloyalty to the king. And so I think it reflects on the character of Ahasuerus. He's not a reckless king imposing his will regardless of the law. He follows Persian law carefully. And as we said in verse 7 and 8, yes, he was angry to hear that Haman had done, when it first dawned on him what Haman had done. But before saying anything, he went out into the garden to compose himself and think through the matter. And that's a lesson for all of us in that sort of situation, to just basically contain ourselves and go out and let our emotions, don't let our emotions get the better of us, to try and cool down and think through the matter. And so then in verse 10, we read of what the king said. After the king said, hang him on those gallows. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and then the wrath of the king abated. So that which Haman used to destroy Mordecai had become the instrument of his own death. What Haman was planning to do, what he built to destroy Mordecai, ended up being the instrument of his own death. Now there's a bit of a parallel here, because Christ was born with flesh and blood, exactly the same as us, so that through his death he could destroy the diabolos, which had the power of death. He had to come under the diabolos's power. Okay, he had to be destroyed himself. He had to die on the death the diabolos delivers to all in order to destroy the diabolos himself. And so Christ's death, in so doing, declared God to be righteous. God is right. Sinful flesh must be put to death. And if we embrace this principle and live by it, God can righteously forgive our sins. Now, the death of Haman did not end the effects of his works, did they? Because we know the decree was still there. And now in less than, I think, from this point, about 7 months, all the Jews were going to still be destroyed. The decree was still there. Haman was dead, but his decree, signed by the king, continued to be legal and effective. Now, the parallel here is that Christ's death in himself, he destroyed the problem of sin. He destroyed the diabolos within himself. Now, that doesn't destroy it for us. We still have to participate. We still have to do something. Okay? Christ's death opened the door for our deliverance out of captivity, out of bondage to sin and death all our life. But it doesn't stop the battle we still face every day against King Sin. We still have to try. We still have to overcome. And, of course, thanks to Christ's victory on the cross, we have the forgiveness of sins. But still we face the battle, don't we, every day. We have to participate. And so this is teaching there's no substitutionary atonement here, is there? Just because Christ died, we're not guaranteed salvation. We have to do something about it. We have to participate. We have to be involved in the process. Christ died for us as our captain, as our example. We have to do our best to follow his example. So what we're learning then at this point with the destruction of Haman is that God is the great strategist who's working out our eternal salvation. God often uses reversals in our life to move us forward and make us wiser. Things were going so well for Esther and Mordecai at first, weren't they? Esther won the crown. Mordecai had been promoted to the king's personal administrative staff. Then, out of nowhere, disaster struck. An egomaniac named Haman got all bent out of shape. He was promoted by the king. And then because one Jewish staff member, Mordecai, wouldn't grovel at his feet, he decided to take his rage out on the entire Jewish population, hoping to settle an old score between the Jews and the Amalekites in the meantime. But think about it. Had this edict never been signed and propagated throughout the whole empire, Esther would never have revealed her secret. She and that she's not a Jew. She and Mordecai, that she is a Jew. She and Mordecai may very well have lived their entire lives in the comfort of the palace and refusing to identify themselves with the remnant of God. It was the threat of impending death, wasn't it? And the hopelessness of this decree, death to all the Jews, that brought about their own personal revival, strengthened their faith and their confidence in God. And so the same with us. God can use such reversals in our life, okay, from a period where everything's going well to a period where disaster strikes and we wonder in our life, what on earth is going on, to bring us back to fully place our confidence, our trust and dependence on him, to realize that of our own ability we're hopeless. And also we've seen that God often uses unlikely events and people to carry out his purpose. Now, as we mentioned before, the king's eunuch, the servant in the corner of the room, spoke up to confirm and made it removed any doubt whatsoever that the king could legally put Haman to death. And so what an unlikely source of support for the Jewish people at that time. A eunuch who'd spent his life just listening and serving and keeping quiet suddenly spoke up and drove the final nail, as it were, into Haman's coffin. So from the world's perspective, he was just one eunuch among thousands, a pawn on the chessboard that no one paid much attention to. But the point is, God uses little people to accomplish great things. As the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20, God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. So isn't it wonderful to see such a weak and insignificant person in this story to move forward to save the day, as it were? And the third point is that God often puts us through great difficulty before providing deliverance. If God simply wanted to deliver us, he could do it quickly and painlessly, but he isn't as concerned with our deliverance as he is with our development through all the trials that we go through. And this is the point of Romans chapter 8, which we know so well, and reading from Weymouth's translation. Now we know that for those who love God, all things are working together for good. All the problems, all the difficulties we go through in life, it's all working together for good. Who for? For those whom God is deliberately working with. God's strategy is working for us on our eternal salvation. For those whom he has known beforehand, he has also predestined to bear the likeness of his son, that he might be the eldest in a vast family of brothers. So God wants us in the kingdom. It's God's good pleasure, as Jesus Christ said. Fear not, little flock. It is your father's pleasure to give you the kingdom. He wants us there. But he's got a strategy to get us there. And that strategy is going to be to develop our character, okay, from the challenges of life, okay, that we face day by day. And fourthly, God will reward us, no matter how insignificant our position is, if we humbly play our role and submit to his providence. So the Apostle Paul made this point too. It doesn't matter what our role is in the ecclesia. In speaking about the divisions that were occurring in the Corinthian ecclesia, he says, "What then is Apollos? What is Paul? They're servants through whom you believed, as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one. Each will receive his wages according to his labor, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building." And so this is the message that Esther's story teaches us. Whether you're a servant in the queen's house or the queen herself, you are a co-laborer, able to play a very important part in God's purpose. And in our lives, both to demonstrate and to deliver the one true saving gospel. Okay, whether it's encouraging our ecclesia, whether it's teaching Sunday school, whether it's preaching the gospel, whether it's just support, being in a support role. We've all got such an important role to play. So don't complain about our circumstances. Submit to God's strategy in our life today. He's the master of the game of our life. He knows not only where we are, not only who we are, but he exactly knows our circumstances we're in. And he's working through that. You might not be satisfied with those circumstances, but God knows, and he's working through those circumstances to get you into the kingdom, which is the most important thing. All right, so let's now come to Esther chapter 8, where we have the story then of a subsequent decree being delivered all throughout the Persian Empire via the Persian Express Post. I don't know, when I refer to the Pony Express, you may know from history that originally our mail was delivered by horses or ponies around the country a long time ago before they had motorbikes. The postal service had motorbikes delivering our mail. But go back 100 years, it was all done by what they called the Pony Express. So the Persians actually effectively invented this. And of course, we read about it in chapter 3, when letters were sent out by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, which was Haman's decree. And this was the first express decree. And so they delivered it to the horses, and the horses then went to all the provinces across the empire in a very rapid manner. And it happens again in chapter 8, the second decree. And this time it's Mordecai's decree, as we'll see. And we read there in verse 10 of chapter 8, then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, special horses bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of people or province that might attack them. So the couriers, in verse 14, the couriers mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, and they rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command. And so now Herodotus, who was approximately around the same time as Ahasuerus' reign, wrote concerning this Persian postal service. He said this, nothing mortal travels so fast as these Persian messengers. The entire plan is a Persian invention, and this is the method of it. Along the whole line of road there are men, they say, stationed with horses, in number equal to the number of days which the journey takes, allowing a man and a horse to each day. And these men will not be hindered from accomplishing at their best speed the distance which they have to go, either by snow or rain or heat or by the darkness of night. Okay, so this is what Herodotus wrote, okay, in BC, 450. The first rider delivers his dispatch to the second, and the second passes it to the third. And so it is borne from hand to hand along the whole line. And so here's a map that just shows one of those famous roads in with the Persian Express, this express delivery system, which went from Susa, or probably from Persia as well. The road probably went down that far as well. But Herodotus particularly makes mention of this as an example of one of the roads going all the way to Sardis here in Ephesus and all the way to Susa in the area of Elam and Babylon. And so Herodotus notes that along this particular route, there were 111 royal staging posts interspersed so that, the riders could keep taking over in relay to deliver the message throughout the empire. Now, it's interesting. Has anyone, these words that Herodotus quoted, these men will not be hindered from accomplishing at their best speed the distance which they have to go by snow or rain, heat, or by the darkness of night. It's very similar to what's engraved here across the front of the New York City Post Office in 8th Avenue in Manhattan. Just coming a little bit closer, you can see there, neither snow nor rain, okay, nor heat. And that's what is written. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these courageous couriers from the swift completion of their appointed round. So I don't know how long they've had that there for. I would probably say over 100 years, but they got it from Herodotus, you know, 2,500 years ago, something that Herodotus wrote became the motto for the US postal system. Now, it was this Persian Express Post that had already delivered the mail from Haman announcing the sentence of death. Now, every Jew throughout the whole empire would have seen that post. They would have read the message on the tree, read the notice on the wall in their little village. Doesn't matter whether they were wealthy or poor. And the word traveled as swiftly around as the riders on their galloping horses, bringing this news of unspeakable terror, grief, and despair. The Jews were seemingly outnumbered and defenseless. But then the tables were suddenly turned in this chapter when Esther risks her life to get the king's attention. And within 24 hours, Haman's plot was uncovered and he was hanging from his own gallows. But as we said, that wasn't the end of the drama. Haman may have been dead, but his edict of death was still very much alive. So Haman's decree had been sealed with the king's royal insignia. You couldn't get out of it. It was the law of the Medes and Persians. So Esther's job was far from over. In fact, now she was actually needed more than ever. Okay, so let's move into chapter 8 now and read verses 1 and 2.
On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman.
Okay, so King Ahasuerus gave all of Haman's property and possessions to Esther. And this was normal. Josephus, for example, informs us in the late kingdom of Persia, treason and felony resulted in the forfeiture of property and wealth to the crown. And in turn, Esther gave that into the hands of Mordecai, okay, and making him all of a sudden the second most wealthy person in the kingdom. So just imagine these two Jewish cousins. Now the two most powerful positions in the Persian Empire other than the king himself. Okay, the queen and the prime minister were Jews. It might look like a series of coincidences, but it was all God's strategy. Not only did Haman lose his life, but his home and his possessions were given to the very Jews who tried to kill. Now let's keep reading now in verse 3 to 6, where we read that Esther once again risks her life before the king.
Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman, the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther rose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?"
Okay, now, the question is, if you look at, as we saw, just verse 1, the king's just elevated Esther and Mordecai. Why did Esther need to go in and interrupt the king, and the king needed to hold out the scepter as if she interrupted the king and it was a dangerous thing to do? She should have. Why did that happen? Some people therefore suggest that from verse 3 happened a few days later or some time later is one possible explanation. But it doesn't seem to be the case, because if you look at verse 15, you know, then Mordecai went out dressed in royal robes and the crown upon his head. That would have happened fairly immediately afterwards. So my suggestion here to resolve this would be perhaps that was the morning on that day, and in the afternoon Esther realized that she needed to go back into the king. She should have brought that up then, but she didn't. So that's why I think this incident happened, when Esther therefore had went out of the king's presence and then some hours later she came back in before him. Now, note that Esther's acting in faith too here. Previously, like we saw, was it in chapter four, Esther needed a lot of encouragement to go in before the king from Mordecai through that messenger Hatach, whose name means truth, back and forth three or four times before she finally, moved to a position of faith to go in before the king. Now she doesn't need that encouragement. She's acting on her own. She's thinking things through herself and able to act, in this spiritual manner now. And now the letters with the king's seal had already gone out to all the provinces calling for the death of the Jews. This was made into a law, that law still stood, couldn't change it. Now Esther requested the king to revoke or reverse or withdraw this law. That's what she asked, wasn't it? Let an order be written to revoke the letters. She wanted, Lord, we're going to cancel that letter and give you deliverance. Now, that wasn't easy for the king to do. Let's read how the king responded in verses 7 and 8.
Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree for the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke."
King Ahasuerus, Esther's appealing before him, she's in tears. And here he's actually seeking to reassure Esther, look, I'm with you. I'm doing everything I can to help you. I'm going to do everything I can. I've killed Haman, but I can't revoke the law that has been written. Now, if the king had a possible way to do that, he would have. But at the same time, his honor and reputation was at stake as well. Why couldn't he repeal the law? Was it pride, Persian customs, or view that the king is infallible? And once he said something, to go back on it, it brings embarrassment on his own name. But I think it's more that the Persian law, once it was set, you couldn't change it. And even he couldn't change it, and he knew that. So the king therefore wisely suggested a workaround, and that workaround was for Mordecai and Esther to write a new decree. Haman wrote the first decree, and now Mordecai and Esther get to write the next one to deal with the first. And so we read about those in decree in verse 11 to 12, and you can see as we read this that it's very similar wording to Haman's decree, deliberately. Mordecai deftly quoted Haman's original edict word for word. So David, verse 11 and 12 of chapter 8, please.
"By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar."
Thanks. So all the Jews in Persia who knew, that first decree, a terrifying message that they'd seen on the wall in their village so many times, they would have caught the significance of the wording of this second decree. Okay? Mordecai was counterbalancing everything Haman had established in the first decree. Everything the Persians were told they could do, the Jews could now do, right? To destroy, to kill, and annihilate any armed force of people that comes to attack them. Children, women included, to plunder their goods. That's exactly what Haman said in the first decree about asking everyone to gather together to kill the Jews. So the Jews were given the legal right to raise an army and take up arms. And in fact, in addition to that, they were given the right to plunder the goods of any Persian who died while attempting to kill them. Now, it's just good to, at this juncture, to remind where we are in the time of the chronology of the Book of Esther. Now, Haman's decree, happened in the first month of the king's 12th year, on the 13th of the 12th month, right? So Haman's decree, and it would be effective in 11 months, which was the final the 14th, the 12th month down here. Now, at this point, we are in chapter 8 with the new decree written by Mordecai. We're in the 12th year of the king, and it's the third month and the 23rd day. So it's between the two decrees, it's just a little bit over 2 months, okay, time between the two decrees. So just imagine, you know, here's the wall of your local village where you see the edict. 2 months earlier, this decree of the king was posted, okay, which was written by Haman. All Jews are to be killed on the 13th of Adar. And all money was going to be given to Haman, because that's what Haman wanted to gather the money to pay into the king's coffers. And but the Persians can take ownership of Jewish land. So 2 months ago, this is what the Persian Express delivered throughout the whole empire. And you can probably imagine that ever since that time, the sound of rushing hoofbeats of horses sent a shudder down the Jewish spines as they feared what news might be delivered from the next place. And so here they hear, once again, 2 months later, the horses rushing frantically into their town and posting another decree on the wall. And here they are in bewilderment, just trying to say that they're bewildered by this decree. But this time, the second decree is posted on the wall. All Jews can defend themselves and kill anyone who attacks them on the 13th of Adar. The Jews can take ownership of their attackers' money and land. So what a relief to all of the Jews after 2 months of despair. And so there was, as you know, Esther 8 reveals, there was dancing, there was celebrating. Their day of death, their day of their death had been turned into their day of deliverance. And another thing this new law did, it warned the Persians that they were no longer allowed to kill and steal from unarmed Jews. There wouldn't be a picnic of plundering. They would be risking their own lives and the lives of their own families if they did, because now the Jews could legally retaliate in self-defense and plunder. So the Persians would have thought all they needed to do now was just do nothing, restrain themselves. No one would get hurt. They would just lay off killing the Jews. If they kept their greed and their animosity in check, no one would die. So, but the lesson here, I guess, is there's two laws. This is Haman's law of sin and death. Okay, and it's like the law of sin and death that we're all born subject to. We can't get out of it. Okay, there's no escaping it. It's our misfortune, isn't it? That we're born like this, but we're going to die. We're born with a nature that is prone to sin, and we're going to die. But what Mordecai's law is effectively the law of redemption. And this is what effectively God has done for us in through Jesus Christ. Okay, by one man sin and death entered into the world, but by another man, by Christ, okay, we have the hope of eternal life, the forgiveness of sins and the eternal life. By one man many were made sinners, as the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 8, by one man many will be made righteous. So the two laws are in place, thanks to what Adam did in the first place. And then when Christ did, we're still bound by that law of Adam, okay, of sin and death, until we are given eternal life when Christ returns. But we have another new covenant in place, okay, which sets us free in prospect, isn't it, from the law of sin and death. And it's a cause of great celebration for us. So in Esther chapter 9 and verse 1, in the 12th month, that is on the month Adar, when the time finally came for this to be, for these two laws to see what would happen, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put into execution, and the enemies of the Jews were still hoping to win, to have power over them, but they didn't. It was turned to the contrary, and the Jews had rule over them that hated them. So that's the parallel with our life, isn't it? And the two laws, the fact that by or the two principles that our life operates on, the law of sin and death that we're born into, but through our baptism we enter into a new relationship. We have a wonderful hope of the forgiveness of sins and eternal life being removed, the problem of the diabolos and its works being completely removed from us as well when Jesus Christ returns. And so this was a message of hope, gladness, joy and honour that was delivered throughout the empire for the Jews. Chapter 8, verse 16 to 17, please, David.
The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honour. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast, and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them.
There was light. Now, it represents a reversal of darkness, doesn't it? Light can be translated as hope. The Jews had hope. But light. Before, 2 months ago, there was darkness. Okay, with Haman's edict. Now, because of this new edict, Mordecai's edict, there was light. The reversal, the opposite of darkness. And so, in every province of the empire, the Jews had joy and gladness. And the Persian Express galloped at full speed across the empire, delivering this wonderful message of light and hope. And it's interesting that, yes, so as I said, they were 2 months ago, it was a message of darkness and death. Now, the Persian Express is a message of light, messengers of light and life. And look at this. At the end of verse 17, it says, many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. Whether they became Jews because they were scared of the consequences of attacking the Jews, or whether they recognized God's sovereign hand upon his people, which I think is more the case, many became Jews. And it reminds us it's similar to the Gibeonites who became Jews as well. They did it by deceit. But why did they want to join with Joshua and make an elite? Because they'd heard about God. They knew his commandments. They knew that he was the true God. Okay, they should have been honest about it, the Gibeonites, and just said that up front, right? And I'm sure that God would have worked and accepted them because like he'd accepted Rahab. But the Gibeonites were the same. They realized that, you know, that they'll be destroyed. There's no other hope of life except by being aligned with the Jews and their God. And so the lesson here is, too, on this message of light as opposed to darkness. That's what we've got to be doing in the world around us. We have to be blameless, innocent, as Philippians 2 verse 15 says, children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. Okay, that's what the world is. It's crooked, it's twisted. Everything that's coming out of the media is like that. It's crooked and it's twisted. The only hope, the only truth, the only hope, gladness, joy, and honor that we have comes from the Word of God. And we've got to be preaching that and emphasizing that amongst each other, with our young people, to our kids, to those around us. We've got to be shining as lights in the world around us. Now, chapter 9, I'm just going to summarize very quickly, and then we'll conclude. What the events of chapter 9 instituted the Feast of Purim. In verses 1 to 5, the 13th of Adar arrives, D-Day, the 12th month. What would happen? The Jews successfully defended themselves throughout the empire. What's remarkable is no Jews were killed. Instead, they destroyed any who tried to attack them. And the rulers of the provinces helped the Jews. And it's likely because they all respected Mordecai. He was great in the king's house, it says, and he waxed greater and greater. I think they could all see that Haman was no good. They didn't like, I think they could see Haman was deceitful, deceptive, and right, he was very political, and conniving. I think that rumor probably spread around, and they had a lot of respect for Mordecai, and everyone appreciated that Mordecai was alive. In verse 6 to 10, we read that in the capital, in Shushan, 500 enemies were killed, in addition to Haman's 10 sons. And in verse 16, elsewhere throughout the empire, 75,000 enemies were killed. Now, upon reading this, you might think that 75,000 Persians, a large number of casualties, fighting must have taken place all over the kingdom, but documents and historians from this time period suggest that the population of Persia was somewhere around 50 million people. Which means then that the actual number of Persians who took up arms against the Jews was comparatively or relatively, on the bigger picture, small. Now, it's interesting in verse 11 to 15 that Esther requested an extra day for the Jews to defend themselves. Okay, so one day on the 13th wasn't enough. And also she requested that Haman's 10 sons, who were already dead, were to be impaled before all. So likely she'd overheard a plot from Haman's family and friends, who were thinking, okay, the Jews can defend themselves on this day, but they won't be able to defend themselves the next day, on the 14th. So we'll rise up, we'll wait one day and rise up against them and try and destroy them. So this is what Esther went back to the king and requested an extra day for the edict to be extended one day. And that's what happened. 300 enemies were destroyed in Shushan on that extra day, and Haman's 10 sons, already dead, were impaled as a lesson before all that what Haman was trying to do and their objectives simply would not be tolerated anymore in the kingdom. And then verse 16 to 19, the Jews rejoiced on the 14th and the 15th of Adar with feasting and gladness, and Mordecai and Esther then make the Feast of Purim, the 14th and the 15th of Adar, so 2 days, an official Jewish holiday to be commemorated. And so what is actually interesting here is that three times in this record of chapter 9, it's stated that the Jews did not lay their hands on the spoil of their defeated enemies. Remember, the edict actually allowed for this. The edict allowed for anyone who attacked the Jews, for them to defend themselves and kill them and plunder their goods. They could take all the spoil, all the property, all the money from anyone who they killed. But they didn't. But three times it says they did not lay their hands on the spoil of their defeated enemies. So I think, first of all, this would have gained a lot of respect from the Persians. And secondly, it's interesting that the Jews not only gained mastery over their enemies, but in so doing, through this incident, they gained mastery over themselves, the greed, you know, in themselves. They were able to constrain it. And so that's an important lesson. The Apostle Paul touches on this in Romans chapter 12, verse 17, doesn't he? Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, and I will repay, saith the Lord. And as he says at the end of Romans chapter 12, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And Mordecai encouraged his countrymen to keep this feast every year. Now, what for? To remember their greatness, the Jewish greatness, and how they successfully defeated their enemies? No, if we read it closely, it's not to remember their individual greatness, but actually their helpless state, and rather their total dependence upon the greatness of God. So that's what Purim is about. That's what you're meant to be thinking about. You're totally helpless, and how great God is, and our total and utter reliance and dependence upon God. All right, sorry for going over time. Now, this is the last slide. We read in Esther chapter 8 and verse 15 that Susa rejoiced at Mordecai's promotion. David, could you read that, please? Esther chapter 8, verse 15.
Now, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad.
Thank you. And also then just cross over to chapter 9 and verse 4.
Well, Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent.
So I think clearly many Persians liked Mordecai. It wasn't, you know, they despised Haman. They were probably disgusted by the gallows that Haman built for Mordecai. And so they rejoiced to see the great reversal. And as it says in chapter 9, Mordecai waxed greater and greater throughout the whole empire. And of course, this is a parallel, you know, the type of Christ, isn't it? The world will rejoice when Jesus Christ is promoted as king. Christ, a Jew, will govern the earth, going out from God's presence. Mordecai went out from the king's presence, Christ from God's presence, in honor and glory as the eternal Father's representative on earth, arrayed in royal robes and a crown of gold. And of course, Christ will wax greater and greater. As 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says, he will reign until all enemies are defeated. And finally, at the end of the millennium, the diabolos, with its power of death, will be completely destroyed. The edict of Haman, as it were, or the edict that Adam introduced, will no longer be. There will be no more death, no more diabolos, completely destroyed. All will be immortal, and God will be all in all. All right, so thank you very much and for listening to this series. And I hope you've got a few lessons out of what we've considered. There's a lot to think about. It's a wonderful story, and it gives us a lot of confidence and hope in times of trouble.